The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.
This week, we are airing two short interviews. The first is with an anarchist legal worker who has been participating in resistance at Standing Rock in so-called North Dakota. This interview is specifically about the grand jury summons, which was recently served to someone who was struggling at Standing Rock. We will speak about what a grand jury is and how people might resist them. Also a bit about what it means for this movement to have a grand jury subpoena occur at this moment. The next interview we will present is a conversation with Scott Campbell, who writes the Insumisión column for itsgoingdown.org. Insumisión is a semi-regular publication which aims to highlight anarchistic and anarchistic struggles and news all around Mexico. Scott and members of IGD are in the process of launching an information gathering and affinity building tour around Mexico in early next year. In this interview, we talk about Insumisión and what inspired it, as well as some of the strategies and influences both North American and Mexican struggle can take from one another, among many other topics. To read Insumisión and for a write-up about the upcoming tour, you can visit itsgoingdown.org and click on the tab labeled Insumisión. You can also check out El Enemigo Común, or The Common Enemy, at elenemigocomun.net. From their website, quote, "This project is an international watchdog against state-sponsored repression. It is the project of a small collective of volunteers in the U.S. and Mexico. We publish and translate communiques, articles, and other media by, about, and for social movements. Our primary focus is on indigenous peoples, women, and youth in both urban and rural communities in Oaxaca, but we also publish about other struggles against neoliberalism throughout Mexico." End quote. Before we start the content, a quick shout out of thanks to KFED for the lovely new image for the series podcast. Much appreciated, buddy. But first, here are some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We'll come like a war! The institution of property is a central component of the hierarch delusion. But if you really think about it, this idea of property is a funny thing. It isn't always easy to distinguish what property is. Before the institution of property came into existence, there was just stuff. Things. If I needed to have a thing, I would just go get a thing, you know, in the place where you typically find things. And if I needed a lot of things, depending on the kinds of things they are, those things became stuff. But once I used a thing, I'd be done with it and just leave it where it is and move on. Or you might need it and take it and use it, and I'd be fine with that because it's just a thing. It's not my thing. Before the institution of property, there wasn't a conception of my things and my stuff, as opposed to your things and your stuff, an idea of ownership. There were just things and stuff, and there was plenty to go around because our population was comfortably low. Then, historically, some asshole took some stuff and put it in a box and put a lock on the box. That stuff became property. His property. Then everyone else, seeing what he did, went to Walmart to buy a bunch of boxes and locks, and we've been screwed ever since. That asshole with a box and a lock didn't just claim ownership over a specific pile of stuff. He created a new relationship to things and stuff. He created the concept of property. If stuff is just out in the open laying around, it's just stuff. Cram it in a box and lock it, it becomes property. Out of the box, stuff. In the box, property. Out of the box, stuff. In the box, property. See? George Carlin, a famous dead guy, once did a whole stand-up bit where he talked about how your house is just a place to put your stuff. And when you get enough stuff, you have to get a bigger house. So I guess in some sense, our houses are just boxes with locks where we put our stuff. But most stuff is useless while in a box, and you have to take it out of the box to use it. And that's where things get complicated, because the stuff is still your stuff. It's still property. So typically, when we take our stuff out of the box, we keep it in our immediate possession or in close proximity to suggest possession. We don't want anyone to get the wrong impression that our property is just stuff. Otherwise, someone else may come along and snatch away our property and claim it as their property. We have a whole set of thinking for this. Well, really, a whole set of not thinking, since we don't really think about it. We know that there are categories of property that are okay to take and categories that are not. For instance, if you're walking alongside the road and you see a penny, you know you can pick up that penny and stick it in your pocket. It's a penny, so it didn't naturally occur there on the side of the road, and that means it belongs to someone. Someone else owned it. But they dropped it or it fell from their pocket, and since it's just a penny, you know nobody's going to miss it, so you can put it in your pocket and keep it. When I was a kid and Jimmy Carter was president, the same was true of a $100 bill, because that was worth about the same as a penny. But I digress. A penny is eminent domain. That means you can put it in your pocket and go. But not so with a wallet full of cash and credit cards. Unlike a penny, if you find a wallet full of cash and credit cards, you know that you're not supposed to put that in your pocket. Just like the penny, someone dropped the wallet or it fell out of their pocket. But unlike the penny, we can assume that someone will come back to look for it because the wallet is property, one of the things that someone locks in his or her box. The most curious thing, I think, is that if you find a wallet and open it and only take out one penny, just like the penny you can find on the side of the road, if a cop sees you do it, you're probably going to jail for theft. Cops are not erudite thinkers. They do not appreciate ironic and philosophical ponderings on the institution of property. But now think about this. At the beginning of the institution of property, most of the property people claimed was land and the equipment for tilling the land. So at the beginning, how did that work? You couldn't very well stick an acre of land in a box and lock it. But what you can do, you can build a box around your land. Fences. Fences are cheap boxes we use to turn land into property. It works on cows and chickens and lots of other things, too. Or should I say, property formerly known as things. Fences were some of the first boxes to lock up property, and they became so ubiquitous, we don't even have the fences anymore. We're so well trained to conceive of property that we no longer need the physical fences to keep us out or to keep us in. Case in point, there's no fence around Trump Towers. But nobody goes into the lobby and claims to have discovered the building and asserts his ownership. Except for that one smelly guy with the tinfoil hat and the cardboard sandals. But nobody took him seriously. Fences are now implied and we unconsciously assume property is property. Something that Columbus and George Armstrong Custer had a hard time grasping, it seems. So what would happen if we all simply recognized our indoctrination for what it is and suspended our adherence to this silly idea that things and stuff are property? What would happen if we all realized nobody has any...
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
What would happen if we all realized nobody has any superior right to anything that we have? And we have no superior right to anything anyone else has. Wow, we'd be liberated. We, ourselves, and our labor, and our energy, and our time, and our lives, would stop being someone else's property. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org. So we are here talking with an anarchist legal worker who has been participating in the Standing Rock resistance. And we're here to talk about the grand jury subpoena, which recently came to a water protector at Standing Rock. Would you briefly explain what a grand jury is for those listeners who don't know and how they have historically been used to divide and subdue radical movements?
Yeah, so what a grand jury is a federal proceeding, and it's intended to produce a federal felony indictment. So in order for a felony indictment to happen, there has to be some process, and it's typically a grand jury process, that determines whether there's enough evidence to proceed with an indictment and formal charges. And while grand juries are used as a way for U.S. attorneys to produce indictments for a wide array of things, they are especially used as a tool of repression towards political movements, resistance movements. And I have a long history of that going back to the origins of grand juries, which are like a holdover from British legal proceedings. So it goes back a really long way. But most recently, people have memory of their use around political resistance movements like the Black Panther Party, American Indian Movement, even more recently, Earth and Animal Liberation Movements.
Gotcha. And I think that like we can remember people like Jerry Koch, who got sent to prison for 9 months for doing grand jury resistance. And I think it was in response to a bombing that happened in Times Square in New York City, I think. I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about what the specifics of grand juries tend to look like on the ground, or like how participants of grand juries, what people have to go through if they are subpoenaed for a grand jury.
So the first step that typically happens when somebody is called to be a witness at a grand jury or provide testimony or physical evidence is that you would be served a subpoena by a federal agent. So in the case of water protectors at Standing Rock, a federal agent could be an agent from BIA or Bureau of Indian Affairs because it's a federal policing force. But oftentimes it would be an FBI agent or even a U.S. Marshal who might serve you the subpoena. And then what that means is that you're required to attend the grand jury and provide information to them. So at a grand jury, they're unlike any other court proceeding where normally there's a judge in the courtroom and you're allowed to have your own counsel, legal counsel, present with you at a legal proceeding. But at a grand jury, there's no judge in the courtroom. The courtroom really belongs to the U.S. attorney and the prosecutor. And you, as a person who's been called to the grand jury, you don't know for sure why you've been called because they operate in almost total secrecy. You don't know if you've been called just as a witness. You don't know if you're the target or the person that they are potentially trying to indict. And so you're also not allowed to have your legal counsel in the room with you. You can and you really should obtain legal counsel if you've been subpoenaed to a grand jury, because it can provide you support in the process of resisting a grand jury. So once you've been served and you're required to go to the grand jury, you have a few options as a person who is looking to resist a grand jury. Your first option is that you can just ghost. That's a really hard option for most people because it means that you can't talk to your friends, your loved ones, your families, your comrades. It means you can't go to the normal places that you go to. It means that you probably need to leave your hometown or maybe even the country as a whole. And some people have done that, and the people that have done that have had very difficult experiences. It also puts you at risk still of being in contempt of court. And my understanding is that if you just ghost after you've received a subpoena, that the contempt can turn into a criminal contempt versus a civil contempt. Which I'll explain a little bit as well. And so your other option would be to basically, some people never walk into the grand jury room. They would just show up, hold a press conference with all of their friends, loved ones, comrades, and their legal counsel, and read a statement in front of the courthouse or in front of the grand jury room, and that says, "We're never going to talk to you. I stand in solidarity with my community, and this is a tool of repression, and I'm part of a impenetrable wall of silence. And people have certainly taken that tactic. Another tactic that people use to resist a grand jury, if they've been called to testify, would be to enter the grand jury room and provide only their name. And then any question that they're asked after giving their name to the U.S. attorney, they would invoke their Fifth Amendment right, which is their right to not say anything that would incriminate yourself. What happens typically, though, is that a prosecutor then says, okay, we get it. Like, you're using your Fifth Amendment right. And then they might let you go for the day, or they might, right on the spot, go have a hearing with a judge in another room. And at that hearing, the judge would almost certainly impose on you immunity. And I say impose because a lot of people have the idea that immunity would be a good thing, right? That they can't say the things that you're saying, the testimony you're providing against you. But the thing is that they can still use it against your friends. They can still use it against the movement as a whole. They could still use it against all kinds of people that you might not be aware of how they would use it. So then once you've had immunity imposed on you, you're no longer allowed to invoke your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. And so then when you refuse to answer questions, then the U.S. attorney is going to say, okay, I get it. You're not going to answer any of my questions. They're going to have another hearing with a judge, and that hearing's a civil contempt hearing, which is not a criminal proceeding. It's a civil proceeding. And what grand juries do if you refuse to cooperate is they try and coerce your cooperation out of you. And if you're charged with civil contempt in that hearing, then they can incarcerate you for up to the length of the grand jury. So like you mentioned before with Jerry out in New York, he was incarcerated for around 9 months. People in the Pacific Northwest who were resisting a grand jury in 2012 were incarcerated for around 4 to 6 months. And that's a coercive incarceration that's meant to pull testimony out of you. But they're not allowed to punitively incarcerate you, which is like all semantics, right? We know that all incarceration is punitive. It's all meant to punish us for something. But they're using tricky legal language that it's not punitive. It's just coercive. We're just trying to torture all of your testimony out of you by incarcerating you and removing you from your community and your loved ones. But because people have used this tactic of like being really public and saying that not only are they personally not going to cooperate and they personally have put up a wall of silence, but also that their whole community is in a silent resistance to this grand jury, then that can be used as evidence further that you're not ever going to cooperate. And something then that can happen is called a grumbles motion, which is a fantastic name and is actually named for people who were a married couple who resisted a grand jury. So it has like a really, you know, beautiful history of its own. But this grumbles motion can be filed by your counsel, by your attorney, and it's basically saying, this person has made it evident and clear that they're not going to cooperate with this grand jury. And this incarceration has gone from coercive to punitive, which is illegal for a civil proceeding, which is what that is. It's a civil contempt charge. And so that's how Jerry was able to get out of coercive incarceration. And that's how, you know, many other people have been able to do that. But I think it also really ties into this like public display community-wide, nationally, even internationally, that people have taken up around grand jury resistance, especially in this last decade, of being really firm and open from the onset, from the moment that they receive a subpoena, instead of being quiet as a community, which is what the feds hope will happen, that you get scared and that you self-isolate. But instead, building on the same like vibrancy in our communities of resistance and that same like loving solidarity that we have, we continue that as our way of resisting.
Definitely. And yeah, like you said, it seems like so many things in the legal system, this is just like a, seems like a pretty diabolical framework for doing this sort of thing. And I think that, you know, like so many things, the success of it just rides on isolation, rides on personal despair even, or like being worn down. And it seems really, really interesting to me and really, really telling that this grand jury subpoena has come pretty hot on the heels of the supposed easement of the Dakota Access Pipeline. I was wondering if you would speak about like the timing of this grand jury subpoena.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's smart for us to be looking at the whole picture like that. You know, on November 20th, there was a battle, kind of a standoff at that Backwater Bridge, which is just on the north end of the Ocheti-Sakowin camp there at Standing Rock, which is the northern camp, and which originally had been like an overflow camp for Sacred Stone and Rosebud on the reservation side. And that battle that happened on November 20th, which a lot of people have now like burned into their memory, not just across the so-called U.S., but really across the world, because of the use of water cannons in, you know, sub-freezing temperatures by Morton County Sheriff. And there was also a young woman, Sophia Wilansky, whose arm was horrifically injured, and another woman named Vanessa, who might lose her eye due to the insane force that was used by Morton County. And so just a little more than a week and a half later, is when this grand jury was convened. And what we know from on the ground is that those things that happened on November 20th on that bridge, what happened to Sophia Wilansky, we know that Morton County sheriffs were already trying to victim blame her, saying that somehow she had blown her own arm off. I personally was on that bridge, and I can tell you that no one was blowing their own arms off there. What I saw was people who were not even really, it wasn't like street fighting that I've seen in any other setting. It was really just people who are so incredibly frustrated and incredibly broken at the just continued horrific use of colonial forces in their territories and in their homelands. And I saw a lot of young Indigenous people who were just trying to turn that knob on the pressure valve and let some pressure off of them that's not just been building for the last, you know, months at Standing Rock, but really people are letting the pressure off of ancestral trauma that goes back more than 500 years. And I think all of that context is really important when we're looking at this grand jury situation as well. What we know about this grand jury is that it has something to do with, at least in part, with what happened on the bridge on November 20th. And we know so far that they are looking at potentially eco-terrorism that's taking place at Standing Rock, which isn't taking place. The only terrorism that's taking place is the terrorism of the state. And the person who received this first subpoena, we believe, has been targeted because of their close proximity to Sophia Wilansky. This is a person who helped to transport Sophia when her arm was injured and get her to medical care. And so there's very little information that anybody has right now about what exactly this grand jury is trying to put together information-wise. But at the end of the day, we don't need to know for sure. We know that it's being used as a tool to repress the work that's happening with water protectors at Standing Rock, and potentially to connect it to other, you know, resistance movements to extraction and environmental terrorism that's happening at the hands of capital in the state. And that first subpoena was received a day before that announcement from the Army Corps about the easement. And I don't think that the timing is coincidental. I think the timing is probably pretty intentional, that when you have a lot of people distracted, feeling like they won, and I don't want to say that that was an entirely false victory, but it's not a permanent victory. You know, I was in the camp when the announcement of the denial of the easement happened, and there were cheers, you know, rippling throughout the camp for the entire day and night, people celebrating and feeling excited. And I do want to recognize that that only happened because of people's collective power, The Army Corps didn't deny the easement. The people who have been fighting this pipeline denied the easement and will continue to deny it, and will continue to deny Dakota Access Pipeline the ability to do what they're doing. And I want to recognize that that is a victory. It's a victory of one battle. And in the long game war, what's happening is that the state, while people are distracted by the victory of that particular battle, are doing this backdoor dealing with a grand jury where they're trying to prey on people who are in resistance to extraction and to the Dakota Access Pipeline, and really to colonialism in general and imperialism in general. This is a movement about indigenous sovereignty and not just about one pipeline. But I think that the timing is really purposeful. And this is also a movement where a lot of people are really new to being in resistance. A lot of people are really new to political and social organizing. And so what is important, and you know, the work that's happening amongst legal workers and supporters at the camp right now, is that there's, because there's so many new, fresh people, it's also a ripe environment for the feds to prey on people who might not understand that what feels like innocuous testimony they might give to a federal agent in or out of a grand jury room, that information is never innocuous to the state. While it might seem like not a big deal to say that you ate dinner with so-and-so, or yes, once you had coffee with so-and-so, the state can then use that to socially map an entire movement of resistance. And that's why people have really taken on this work, running full speed ahead and moving as quickly and strategically as possible to disseminate the information and make sure that people aren't just distracted by the victory of one battle, because there's a whole war that we're trying to fight right now.
I think that's a fantastic point, because I've been seeing a lot of discussion about like, yay, we won, we can like go home now or whatever. But I was wondering, maybe you've already answered this as much as you want to, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts on like how real the easement is, or like how permanent you think it is. Like, do you think it that people will just start come back and start building once, you know, the regime has flipped, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, things up there are a pretty delicate situation. The tribal government of Standing Rock and their chairman, Dave Archambault, you know, in the beginning, he said that a reroute would never be a victory for the people of Standing Rock and for Sioux Nation. And the only victory would be a complete block of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Well, now you have Dave Archambault, who came to the camp and drove around in his personal pickup truck, you know, announcing to people that they had won and that people could return to their homes. And what is suspected to be happening with this, you know, denial of the easement by the Army Corps is they're denying the easement in that spot at the Oahe Lake, which is actually just a lake that's resulted by the damming of the Missouri River, which is a whole other history that I think I encourage people to look into, the way that the Missouri River has been a point of struggle for the people of Standing Rock and for Sioux Nation for many, many years. And so, you know, denying the easement in this one tiny spot on Lake Oahe or the Missouri River is not a victory, because we all, tens of millions of people, rely on the water from the Missouri River. It's the largest water basin in this region of the country. And putting the pipeline crossing of the Missouri River 20 miles north, or, you know, 40 miles north, is still going to result in the same risks for everybody who drinks that water and for all the people of Standing Rock and for all the people of Sioux Nation. And so I think it's important for people to be examining, you know, I'm an anarchist. I'm always examining the people who hold power. And I think, you know, my Indigenous comrades who are up there or have been up there at Standing Rock, they also come from the perspective that somebody who's in tribal government, these are governments that mirror colonial government and colonial power. And so there's something to question there. This isn't the ways in which traditionally Indigenous people of Sioux Nation would have governed themselves. And if we're going to be talking about being in solidarity with Indigenous sovereignty, then we as non-Native people, allies and accomplices to them, need to be following their lead. But we also need to be critical of whose lead we're following and what kind of power those people are wielding. But I think that there's a lot of people who are not going home. And I think that's really important to remind people right now that there are hundreds and hundreds of people who will not be returning home. Over on the reservation side, at Sacred Stone and Rosebud Camp, there are still around 600 or more people on that side. At Ocheti Sakawin, which is, I believe, has actually been renamed to Ocheti Oyate, which that rename has come from the Indigenous Youth Council and from this person, Chase Iron Eyes, who actually had run for U.S. Congress. He did not win, which I think is a good thing so that he can stay in the community as opposed to, like, you know, ascending to national power. But Chase Iron Eyes is actually from Standing Rock. Him and his wife have been fighting this pipeline really along with the people, and he's stepped into a real role of leadership that I think is a positive, looks like a really positive role of leadership. And he is encouraging people, along with LaDonna Allard, whose land Sacred Stone is on, is one of the founders of Sacred Stone Camp, are telling people, don't go home, that people who are already there need to continue to hold space, to continue to fight this pipeline, and also to continue to assert Indigenous sovereignty over those lands that don't belong to North Dakota and were never ceded by the people of Standing Rock and Sioux Nation.
Definitely. So earlier in the interview, you spoke a lot about ways to resist grand juries, the ghosting, press conferences, and invoking the Fifth Amendment. Are there any other ways that you would recommend people fighting grand jury scrutiny?
Yeah. So the first thing I said a little bit earlier, but I think it bears repeating, it's scary when you are the person who receives a subpoena, and it's meant to be scary. That's the tool that the state is using, is to be this big, scary, secretive entity that intends to isolate you. So number one, reaching out to people and not staying silent, I think is one of our strongest tools. And also that I think the grand jury that happened in the Pacific Northwest, the grand jury that happened with Jerry out in New York, I think these are really great recent examples. Grand jury with Carrie Feldman in Minnesota a few years ago as well are really great examples of building not just localized community resistance, but really started reaching out through these really vibrant national networks of anarchists, anti-authoritarians, and radical people. And so I think doing that as well, like reaching out in through all of the networks that we have, whether they're political or personal networks, and building these ways of resisting together. Also, the Water Protector Legal Collective and the National Lawyers Guild have a really strong presence up there at Standing Rock. And they are doing a lot of work in the camp and out of the camp to help mount resistance to this grand jury and offer the support necessary. So just as a heads up to any person who, because people who are possible targets for subpoenas for this grand jury, so many people have come and gone from Standing Rock that you could be back home in Ohio and receive a subpoena. You don't have to be at Standing Rock or in North Dakota or that region of the country to be subject to this risk. And I don't say that to stoke any fear, but just to be really honest with people that you may have come and gone, but this is still a possibility. So reaching out to the Water Protector Legal Collective as quickly as possible, really important, because they're able to offer legal counsel that could represent you through the grand jury process. They're able to connect you to those networks of resistance that are already existing if you yourself might not already be plugged into them. Water Protector Legal Collective has a website, which is waterprotectorlegal.org. But if you received a subpoena, you should call them immediately, 24 hours a day. They have a hotline, and the number is 605 519-8180. And also, right now, people who want to help support grand jury resistance, donating to the Legal Collective Fund is especially helpful. Not only is that legal fund that exists through the Water Protector Legal Collective going towards supporting people's criminal cases, it's also going towards supporting the people who are up there doing legal work, who've left their homes and their families, you know, back in their own communities and are up there doing that work. And the amount of resource that's necessary to help 571 people, and that number of people with criminal cases is growing, to help those people with their criminal cases, also fighting a grand jury, also trying to support the people who have given up their lives at home to be engaged in full-time legal support. So donations are vital, and that is a way that people at home and outside of Standing Rock can continue to support not just grand jury resistance, but also all the people who are facing criminal charges as well.
Definitely. And we will repeat the number and the website after this interview. I was wondering, you mentioned looking into the cases of recent grand jury resistance as a way to be more informed, but are there any other resources for grand jury resistance that you would recommend to listeners?
Yeah, so I would say one of my number one favorite spots for grand jury resistance information is there's a lot of really great detailed information that's available through the Civil Liberties Defense Center from Eugene, Oregon. And their website is the cldc.org. And they have a number of resources that are available on there, both for a person or, you know, people in a community that are thinking about grand juries, but also resources available for legal workers or attorneys about grand juries and how to fight them when they're being used against people in political or social resistance. Other really good stuff that's out there, CrimeSync has some information. Also, the Midnight Special Law Collective has a grand jury training available on their website, which is midnightspecial.net. And there's also some really good like history and information that's available through the Freedom Archives. On the Freedom Archives, if you just search on there, which is freedomarchives.org, you can search grand jury or grand jury repression or things like that. There's a lot of really good information on there, and there's a lot of good historical context about how grand juries have been used against people in social and political movements, like people, you know, Puerto Rican independentistas, people from American Indian movement, and the long history of grand jury use and FBI repression.
That's totally excellent. That is all the questions that I have typed up. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add?
I think the only thing that I would want to add is, you know, I think that there's a lot of really exciting and beautiful and hopeful things that are coming out of this movement at Standing Rock. We're seeing that spirit of resistance spread from Standing Rock Reservation, which probably most people had never heard of until, you know, a few months ago. But that's spreading out not just across this country and continent, but really globally. There's global solidarity for this. And I think I really want to drive home to people who are non-Native people, who are allies and accomplices to Indigenous people who are in this struggle, that part of what I feel like our responsibility is when we're in solidarity with Indigenous people who are fighting for sovereignty, that we not only be in solidarity with them on the front lines, we not only be in solidarity with them in those kind of glamorous moments of resistance, but that we be in continued solidarity with them when the repression, the inevitable repression, comes raining down on those movements of resistance. And that we really take it very seriously that the grand jury, the feds, and local law enforcement, Morton and Burley County law enforcement, that this isn't something that's just going to be happening in this next couple of months, that the repression that's going to be coming against people who are in struggle for Indigenous sovereignty over their lands, their water, their communities, their spiritual practices, that this repression is going to last for a long time. And then I hope that non-Native allies and accomplices are in it for the long haul as well. And thank you so much for giving us some time to talk about that on the final show.
Oh, buddy, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for making the time to do this, too. And stay safe out there. We just spoke with our comrade, who is an anarchist legal worker currently participating in resistance at Standing Rock in Cannonball, North Dakota. If you have been contacted by federal agents in relation to Standing Rock, please call the Water Protector Legal Collective immediately at area code 605-519-8180. To donate to this collective and to learn more about the work they do, you can visit their website at waterprotectorlegal.org. To look again at our guests' suggestions for further research, you can visit our blog on No Blogs or on ashevillefm.org. Or go to itsgoingdown.org and scroll through to the article entitled Grand Jury Resistance at Standing Rock. And here's our interview with Scott Campbell. So the first question I have is, would you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do?
Absolutely. My name is Scott Campbell, and I live in Oakland, California. I am involved with a variety of projects locally, but what I spend most of my time doing is translations and writing about resistance, repression, social movements, and organizing happening in Mexico. I do it for two main websites, one being itsgoingdown.org, where I have a column called Insumisión, and we also do translations and trying to get the word out about what's happening in Mexico, and as well as elenemigocomun.net, which is a bilingual website that's been around for more than 10 years at this point that is dedicated to social movements in Mexico.
That's awesome. How long is Insumisión? What did that start as part of It's Going Down, or did you write it before It's Going Down became a platform?
It started, the first one came out in March of this year, and since then we've done 14. I aim to get it out every 2 to 4 weeks, depending on how much time I have. It's Going Down has been around for a little more than a year, and some of the other people involved with that project approached me, and they were familiar with my work from El Enemigo Común and said they were really trying to bring more of a focus to what was happening in Mexico, as IGD is dedicated to covering events all around North America, including Mexico. And they didn't have a dedicated Mexico person, someone fluent in Spanish. So we tossed around this idea of doing a sort of roundup of events with what was happening in Mexico. And that's what turned into the Insumisión column. And it's actually been really well received. And I think not to hold myself up or It's Going Down up as something special, but as far as I'm aware, it's the only sort of regular column of its type that documents ongoing resistance and repression in Mexico in English. So hopefully it's a valuable resource, and we've had fun putting it out and making sure that word gets spread to comrades in English about what is happening with comrades down in Mexico.
Definitely. It seems crazy to me that it would be the only article of its kind. I mean, I believe you, but what do you think is going on there?
I think that there's not really a lack of coverage of stuff from Mexico, but there, with all the people have going on in the U.S. and all the projects they're involved with and all the repression and resistance we're organizing up here, it's hard to, you know, consistently keep an eye on what's happening in Mexico and be dedicated to spreading the word about it. When things do happen, such as when the teacher strike kicked off this past summer that led to a more generalized revolt in some parts of the country, people were paying more attention and we saw more translations and interviews and events and that sort of thing. But when there's more the general consistent mobilization that doesn't grab the headlines as much, it falls off people's radar. And I think, as we know, we can't rely on sort of mainstream media to do that work. NGOs dedicated to covering Latin America and Mexico don't seem particularly interested in talking about the forms of organizing and resistance that we're interested in. So I think it's been a unique opportunity where It's Going Down has had the inclination, and I've fortunately have the space and capacity to take this on. And so we've been able to churn these out pretty regularly.
That's excellent. Would you talk about your upcoming tour and what inspired it?
Sure. I'll be headed down to Mexico in a couple months, and I'll hope to spend about 4 or 5 weeks there. It came around because I've been traveling to Mexico since 1999 and cumulatively have lived there for about 3 years, been involved in a variety of projects, working on social centers, assisting with various organizing efforts, and also mainly trying to build connections that we can bring back to the U.S. and share information, news, solidarity, and ways of conceptualizing struggle and means of organization. And it's been about 5 years since I've been down there last and was entertaining the idea of just making a trip to visit some friends. And then I thought, well, hey, I do this writing for It's Going Down. I've developed a lot of contacts with organizations I hadn't been in touch with before as a result of Insumisión and the translations that we do. It'd be great to expand this trip to actually not only say hi to people I've known for years, but to sit down with them and others to hear about what sort of projects are happening, what sort of repression they're experiencing, how are they conceptualizing struggle, autonomy, anti-capitalism, anarchism, where do these overlap, where are they different. In particular, I think what's fascinating for me about Mexico and has a lot of valuable lessons to apply to the U.S. context is that there's a lot of organizing there that doesn't call itself anarchist and really has no association with the ideological construct that many of us in the U.S. hold, but in implementation looks very similar. And of course, people are probably familiar with this applies primarily to indigenous communities who have their own forms of governance and social interaction and social systems in place that strive for autonomy and self-determination, anti-capitalism, no elections or sort of the democratic processes we're familiar with. And so there are several overlaps with anarchism, but they don't call themselves anarchist. And I think that too has played some role in some resistance in Mexico falling off the radar of radicals in the U.S. because while the goals and aspirations are often quite similar, the language and conceptualization are different. And so I want to bring kind of within my means and the time frame and capacity that I have to sit down with sort of anarchists organizing autonomous spaces and projects in Mexico City, independent media efforts, comrades in Oaxaca talking about with anarchist teachers who are involved in the teacher strike over the summer, to look at what's happening in Chiapas with this proposal from the Zapatistas and National Indigenous Congress to potentially run a presidential candidate in 2018, and to visit indigenous communities who are organizing against a variety of neoliberal projects, be it highways or mining or dams or wind farms, who've also been actively organizing both against drug cartels and the state, kicking out political parties, kicking out municipal police, organizing things according to what suits the community best as determined in community and what that looks like. And to hopefully make as much material, be it podcasts, video, written articles, interviews, photos, that sort of thing, available in English, and to build this sort of shared affinity that I believe exists and that many people do feel drawn to, and to make it more explicit and to make it more accessible. And granted, I'm just one person and it's not going to, you know, renovate social relations between radicals in the U.S. and Mexico, but hopefully at least on the website of It's Going Down, bring a little more light to some of what's happening in Mexico, because it's inspiring, it's amazing, it's creative, they're facing brutal repression, and I think it deserves as much attention as possible.
Definitely. That's super, super cool. This idea of radicals in the U.S. being like, these aren't the words you used, but the words I'm going to use, like somewhat dismissive or like not really paying attention to certain struggles in Mexico because the language isn't right, is really interesting to me. And I wonder what your opinion on like why that might be is, or why it seems that U.S. rads or U.S. anarchists are perhaps a bit more focused on like ideology or language or a little bit more hardline about those things. Do you have any opinions on that?
I do have opinions. I mean, for me, I can speak to the sort of process as it occurred to me that I think others may be able to relate to, which is that, you know, years ago now when I came to anarchism, it was very much my initial formation politically, ideologically, socially, in the scene and around actions was guided by the sort of European conceptualization of anarchism. And when I went to Mexico, a lot of my assumptions around how radical work was done was drastically challenged. And I learned that I actually knew very little, and that there was that opposed to me bringing ideas and ways of doing things, people there were very well equipped and had much more deeper rooted knowledge and culture of resistance than what I was familiar and what I was drawing from in terms of the European anarchist practice. And I think it's, to a degree, a resistance rooted in a legacy of course, colonialism and neoliberal capitalism. And many folks in Mexico, many radicals in Mexico, are indigenous, identify as indigenous, and the indigenous resistance hasn't been as effectively suffocated and genocided as it was in the U.S. So that legacy is alive, and it's still very resilient and very prominent in many areas. There are still communities in Mexico who proudly claim they've never been conquered by the Spanish or the Mexican government for more than, you know, several centuries now. So I think in the U.S., we are used to a certain framework that has worked with varying degrees of success with our contemporary context, but the context in Mexico is also very different. And the ways of communicating, of relating to one another and conceptualizing resistance, the foundational aspects of that around community, around self-determination, autonomy, come from different sources that often correspond with sort of the inspiration from anarchism. As we can see, like Ricardo Flores Magón was indigenous. He came from an indigenous village in Oaxaca and is, you know, super well known as an anarchist. And the village where he came from is still battling for autonomy and has several political prisoners at the moment. And they identify as anarchist and indigenous, their adherence to the Sixth Declaration of the Zapatistas. They're battling political parties and police and murder charges and all sorts of things in their village. But it's not, I'm not sure how to say this. I think the practice of being in community and sitting in assembly and making decisions together that have real implications on how things are carried out within a community, and there's much more accountability than I think in, especially in urban settings such as Oakland or New York, where we find a lot of anarchist activity, it means there are greater consequences. So there's greater adherence to a way of doing things, and also more dedication to resolving conflict in a more constructive way. For me, a comrade at IGD we were talking about this and how it's interesting that many anarchists in the U.S., for example, can tell you all about Rojava, which is thousands of miles away, Kurdish, Arabic, mainly because people start talking about Murray Bookchin over there. But how many folks know about what's happening in, say, Chiran, Michoacan, which for 5 years, 20,000 people rose up, kicked out political parties, kicked out police, drove the drug cartels out of the area, and have been organizing autonomously within this small city, and then organizing more regionally and bringing together other indigenous and non-indigenous communities to battle against both the state and cartels. When that's in Spanish, a very accessible language, and, you know, a 3-hour flight away. So I think because the transmission of knowledge and somewhat pre-instilled biases that may exist even within our conceptualization of anarchism play out in how we bestow certain legitimacy on some struggles and others we don't pay as much attention to. Another issue, of course, would be the transmission of information. A lot of these communities are isolated. When news does get out, it's often in text that's written in an indigenous language and then translated into Spanish, and you have to know where to look in order to find it. Oftentimes it doesn't give much information, whereas other places in the world that have access to Twitter, Facebook, videos, more polished translations, things are more appealing and more easily digestible. So the work of a lot of communication with Mexico, it does require more work and more effort and dedication. That is slowly changing, and it's one of the things I hope to address while I'm down there, is kind of, again, not to put myself on a pedestal, but to bring up to make more accessible in English some of the amazing work that's happening there. And there are other comrades who are doing this too. By no means am I the only one, but hopefully I can contribute my small piece.
I was wondering, I was reading the most recent Insumisión today, and I was really interested in this concept of community self-defense, because the most recent Insumisión, which people can find on It's Going Down, discussed this topic at some length. And since Trump's election, especially in communities that I know, rad or anarchistic communities, have been talking a lot about community self-defense. And I was wondering if you could touch on the differences between how you see this happening in the U.S. versus how it has been an ongoing thing in Mexico.
That's a great question. And it's something that I think I even mentioned in the intro of the piece, that while there are a lot of distinctions, I think that the work that's happening in Mexico to defend communities, both from the state, from corporations, and from cartels, is something we can, if nothing else, take inspiration from while we think about that in the U.S. moving forward under Trump and his administration. I think an important distinction to touch on that first is that in Mexico, in many of the places where one sees this happening, the state is not as well entrenched as it is in the U.S. So it's possible for a community, or more possible, by no means easy and by no means simple, but to get together and decide that they want an alternative way of being in community together. And so if that means getting rid of political parties, if that means removing the municipal local police force, they can do that. There's also several laws and conventions that Mexico has signed on to and passed, which allow the state more leeway in permitting that to occur within certain limits, obviously. But they're also very adept at arming paramilitaries, of sending in the police. I mean, they have the first response from the Mexican state is always the bullet, and then negotiations if that fails. But I think the starting point when we think about community self-defense in the U.S., especially under Trump, is, you know, finding safety in that resistance. And that's what communities in Mexico have done. They were threatened by the state, by corporations, by cartels, and they found safety in resisting that and implementing their own way of life, decision making, and self-management and autonomy. And I think what can inspire us here in the U.S. is coming together in communities, whether they be geographic, whether they be based on different affinities or identities, and looking at how does the state, how does capitalism, how do these phenomenons of Islamophobia, white supremacy, patriarchy, heteropatriarchy, and so on, impose themselves on us? What are the threats we're facing, and what are our means of resistance and self-defense? And while self-defense sometimes takes shape individually, it's much more powerful and much more coherent when we do it in community. And I think in a time when things are going to get worse and there's a lot of fear and trepidation, and we already carry with us so much trauma that, and it's only going to amplify, I think we can take inspiration from communities coming together in Mexico who said, we've had enough of how things are being done. We have a legacy. We have a framework for doing things in a much different way that happens to also be more autonomous, more respectful and empowering of the individual in community, and that also meets the needs of the individuals as opposed to the needs of the state or corporations. And we too carry with us that framework here in radical and anarchistic communities in the U.S. And I think we can, the first step is coming together and having these conversations and realizing that our commitment and our dedication is going to be tested, and our need to stand together is going to be more necessary than ever, and to critically examine what's worked, what hasn't, what tools do we have, what resources can we draw upon, and how can we find that safety and resistance. I don't know if that comes close to answering your question.
It definitely does. And I also wanted to highlight this brief quote from your article, which was, it names community self-defense as being essential but none too glorious. So I think that, and if anybody who is interested in doing so would, might be in for a little bit of an arduous time, I think it's a good thing to contemplate.
And I guess if it helps anyone feel any better, the one similarity between anarchism and say community organizing in Mexico is that we both have very lengthy and numerous meetings. So we're on the right track there, at least.
I'm glad it's not only us.
Yeah.
So the tour is going to happen early next year. Is that what you said?
That's right. Hopefully in February or March. And well, I'll be going to at least hitting up Mexico City, Oaxaca, and Chiapas, and to see what else is around. I want also not make too fixed of plans, because who knows what's going to be happening in February, March. But I'll be visiting with autonomous self-managed spaces in Mexico City, like I mentioned, indie media projects, teachers, something on the Zapatistas, indigenous villages and resistance, and I'm looking at resistance to extractive industries, the battle against femicides and patriarchy. And there's just like in the U.S., actually, I mean, it'd be as if someone were coming from Mexico to do a tour of U.S. resistance. I mean, there's a plethora of issues, a lot of magnificent organizing happening, and a lot of lessons that can be drawn from it, as well as just, you know, the comrades in Mexico, at least that I've spoken to, really appreciate the fact that it's going down is putting more of an effort into bringing news about what they're up to in English, and they appreciate just that show of solidarity. And I think it helps open the door to, you know, broader manifestations of solidarity and realizing that, especially given the nearness of Mexico and the deep involvement of the U.S. in Mexican affairs, there are a lot of opportunities. And this is just one way for that conversation to deepen and to reinforce, you know, both those of us up here and those of us down there.
Certainly. And it's also happening at such an interesting moment, too, for activism in the U.S., not just because of how the rise of Trump has messed things up, but also because of the popularity that movements like Standing Rock has generated. And struggles like Standing Rock are by no means, that Standing Rock is by no means unique in the U.S., because resistances like that have been happening since extractive industries have been a thing. But the popularity that it has gained, the amount of, you know, energy it has injected into all sorts of different political spheres has been pretty amazing. So I think that giving voice to struggles, indigenous struggles, teacher strikes, all of these things in Mexico, which is, like you said, only a 3-hour flight away, is coming at a really good time for at least us in the U.S., if I can, you know, be somewhat self-absorbed with that. Are you looking for any additional resources about the tour? And where can people learn more information about what you're doing?
Well, people can learn more information. We'll, of course, be posting the materials we produce up on itsgoingdown.org. And in the meantime, people can check that out for the next Insumisión column, which will probably be coming out in January, as well as our ongoing translation efforts. We have some solid audiovisual equipment already, camera, tripod, audio recorders, mics, that sort of thing, and then the software to edit those. So we're set with that. But we are looking for, if people are interested and they find the work and the project valuable and have the capacity to do so, if they could contribute financially, we've got a crowdfunding site set up. It is rally.org/IGD-Mexico, and they can donate there. We're trying to make this trip as inexpensive as possible. I won't be doing any tourism activities there. It'll be, you know, living with comrades, hanging out, doing interviews, producing media, and really trying to amplify the voices and the resistance that's happening there. And as well, if people have projects or people they feel we should be in touch with that they're not hearing about in our reports, or they think it's really worth looking into, by all means, shoot us an email at info@itsgoingdown.org. We're really interested in, I by no means am an authority on Mexico. I just happen to know a little bit, and it helps me write these things. But I know there's lots happening. It's an entire country, 130 million people. So if there's something going on that you think would fit in well with the initiative of this tour, by all means, please do let us know.
I definitely look forward to hearing how the tour went and what you got out of it and what was surprising to you and all this stuff. So definitely, I'd love to hear about it after you're back as well.
Absolutely. I'll be more than happy to share. And
cool.
Hopefully we'll have lots of good stuff to share.
Excellent. Those are all the questions that I had. Did you have anything else you'd like to add?
I don't. Thank you just kindly for having me on and for this opportunity. And thanks for those who are listening and supporting the work of Radical Anarchist Media. And it's going down in the final straw. And it's really exciting to see all of us supporting each other, bringing our different perspectives. And I think it's great. And I look forward to working with everyone moving forward.
Agreed. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We just spoke with Scott Campbell about his upcoming tour aiming to highlight radical struggle in Mexico. To read all of Insumisión, which I highly recommend, you can visit It's Going Down. To donate to the tour and to see a write-up about it, you can visit the rally.org website, rally.org/IGD-Mexico. Also, don't forget to check out El Enemigo Común at elenemigocomun.net. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina, and this is The Final Straw Radio.